Case number 21-2911, Ricky White versus Randy Reworks. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Gabara, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning. Suzanne Gabara on behalf of Mr. Ricky White. I have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
The gist of the facts in this case are that Mr. White, through his company, Brownstein & Associates, promised homeowners that he would be applying for loan modifications for them, charge an upfront fee with a money-back guarantee, that he had an attorney on staff to assist with these applications when he did not have an attorney on staff, and that claimed that he never worked on these applications or did not submit them. Mr. White pled guilty as charged and went back to the trial court afterwards, claiming that his plea was unknowing and involuntary due to ineffective assistance of counsel. I'll get to the issue of the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel first. As this court has seen many claims before, and certain facts scream out ineffective assistance of counsel, and I think Mr. White's case is one of them. You have an attorney who was on a case for less than 2 days, did not request discovery or review voluminous documents, was unfamiliar with the facts, other than perhaps Mr. White's capacity to pay restitution, pocketed approximately $10,000 in restitution money, and eventually coerced Mr. White to plead guilty due to his wife being charged with a felony and his children being taken away.
Yeah, I mean, I understand your points there. It seems like the thrust of your argument really focuses on the idea of deficient performance, but you also have to show prejudice. And with respect to a claim that ineffective assistance caused the defendant to plead guilty when he otherwise shouldn't have, I mean, the Supreme Court's been clear that to show prejudice, your client would need to convince the court that a decision to reject the plea bargain would have been rational under the circumstances. And also that, but for counsel's errors, he would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. Those are from a couple of Supreme Court cases. Here, the Michigan Court of Appeals said your client had no viable defense. And so, granted, you know, the lawyer was there for a short time, but I'm having a very hard time seeing how the Michigan Supreme Court was unreasonable in concluding that your client did not have any viable defense, and that, ergo, there wasn't any prejudice here. Just to be candid.
I believe that Mr. White has shown that he had a defense with the volume of evidence he submitted to support his affidavit. For one, there were two agreements that were attached to his affidavit that were the contracts that his client signed that said his company, Brownstein & Associates, are not attorneys. Mm-hmm. Their clients should seek legal advice and before acting on the recommendations provided by the company. Those are two contracts that the client signed.
Right. And that's, you know, form language that's buried in a contract. If there's a mountain of evidence otherwise that your client is acting quite contrary to his representations about, e.g., a money-back guarantee and about, you know, the way that they're going to try to seek these modifications, that language really doesn't matter very much.
But the gist of the Michigan court's rejection of his claim were, you said you had no attorneys on staff, and two, you didn't work on the loans. But he did, in fact. The voluminous exhibits that were submitted on his 6500 motion show the time logs and sheets. The courts simply ignored them just because you said you had no attorneys on staff. We're not going to look. Even if he had said, I was outside with a gun in my head and then walked in and pled guilty, Michigan courts were not going to consider anything he said. They just simply ignored his affidavit because what he said.
He had said the opposite when he pled guilty.
Well, let's look at his affidavit.
And those are two different things. And I understand your argument that, I mean, you at least think the Michigan court was applying some per se rule and that the Supreme Court has said, you know, don't do that, as to whether he can basically disprove his own testimony during the plea hearing. I understand that.
They did apply that per se rule.
But it doesn't matter if you can't show prejudice. And I think we review this deferentially under AEDPA. I mean, you can tell me if you think I'm wrong, but when the state court says your client had no viable defense, and that's part of the reason he loses in state court, Court of Appeals, that's on the merits, that goes directly to prejudice. That's how we measure prejudice in these kinds of IAC claims. And could a rational jurist say that? I think this boils down to whether a rational jurist could say your client had no viable defense.
Let's look at this
thing. I'm struggling to see how a rational jurist actually could say he did have a viable defense.
But he did. To show, just the fact he said that I have no attorneys on staff, that would have not barred him from having a defense to false pretenses. He would have to show reliance. And the fact that he, those statements, yet it's language in a contract that presumably the client had to have reviewed and signed, and he never had the opportunity to present that defense. His attorney, who was on a case for a day and a half, talked to him for the plea hearing lasted for approximately 25 minutes. No attorney, not even a reasonable attorney, could have, under that time frame, reviewed all these documents and render advice on pleading guilty as charged, or talk about any defenses. And in fact, because White would have to show reliance on the statements, even if he said, I have an attorney, those two contracts and the fact that he did in fact work on these loan modifications, which were the gist of why Michigan courts rejected his agreement, just because you have no attorney, but they never reviewed the documents in support of his affidavit, which brings me to the per se rule that was applied. If you're going to say they didn't come and compare, okay, let's look at what you submitted. Let's see if this, in fact, would give you a defense, and then we're going to say you had no defense. They just simply said, because you made one statement at your plea hearing, and now you've provided an affidavit that differs. And if you compare the two affidavits, other than the statement that I did not have an attorney on staff, for the most part, his affidavit, in fact, reconciles with what happened at the plea hearing. I mean, he said that my attorney was not prepared, that he did not discuss the defenses with me, and ultimately rushed me into pleading guilty. And again, I stated that the entire hearing lasted for about 25 minutes, and his attorney admitted that he was on the case for a day and a half. Then he said his attorney returned from a conference and told him that he had to plead guilty because his wife would be charged and his kid would be taken away. The plea transcript says, the trial court, and I quote, I know there was a discussion about the wife. Does it involve him? His attorney responds, that's the plea agreement, that if in fact he fled today, his wife would be charged. I mean, that reconciles with Mr. White's affidavit that his attorney was just got on the case and then really rendered no advice, just says, take it or leave it. You've got 5 minutes.
Let me ask you this. Under our the legal standard we're looking at, it would appear that your client's argument is predicated pretty much on the post-colloquy affidavit. And as best I can tell, there's no clearly established federal law that is unconstitutional for a court not to consider a post-colloquy affidavit. So even though your client might have a pretty good argument in and of itself under the upper standard of review, if your client's affidavit is not agreed to as a matter of the review of your client's argument, your client still will come out on the short end of the argument. Let me ask it like this. Do you have a case that says that, or case authority, that the barring of such affidavits is not clearly established Supreme Court precedent?
Well, we cited to Blackledge, both in the district court and on our brief here, and the district court denied that Blackledge was clearly established federal law because of the statement in it that is applicable to procedure only in federal courts. But I don't agree with that statement because I believe Blackledge...
But Blackledge is a pre-EPA case. That's the problem with Blackledge.
Understood, but Blackledge also lays out two situations when attacking a plea. I understand it's a pre-EPA case, but Blackledge lays out that there are two situations. The first situation is if you're going to attack your plea based on misrepresentation or duress, you can provide evidence that can support that. Or two, the alternative, you can't just make conclusory statements. And district courts and other courts post-Blackledge have looked at Blackledge as the guidance as to how do they review cases where someone wants to withdraw their plea. And they've looked at these situations as a base. Is someone providing statements that are not just conclusory? Is someone providing evidence beyond what the statements are? I mean, I cited to Lee, and I know this is a 2255 case, but I think Lee is important to show the circumstances of taking a plea. There's not a perfect way or a mechanism to take a plea, whether it's in a 2255 petition or 2254. However, I think that when somebody provides evidence that is beyond just his affidavit, as did Mr. White here, the courts should be able to look at that. Otherwise, this per se rule, if you have that, it's in violation of the Constitution, and no one can ever come back and challenge their plea at the state court level. And I don't believe the Constitution supports that. I don't believe Blackledge supports that. And
Could I ask a question, counsel?
Yes.
Just so I understand the structure of the argument, you agree that AEDPA applies in this case?
Yes.
Okay. So it applies to a particular decision of the state court, correct?
Yes.
Did that decision, the one that AEDPA applies to and that we should look at in this case, did it rely on performance or prejudice or both?
The Court of Appeals talked about performance. First,
what they relied on.
On both. I mean, they talked about performance and then...
So if we have to give deference with respect to the prejudice issue and find that because of that you lose on the prejudice issue, then you would lose, right? I'm not saying you do. I'm just trying to understand the structure. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, that's all I was asking. Thank you.
However, I believe that Mr. White has shown prejudice, both under Strickland and under Cronic. Under Strickland, he's shown that he did have a defense and had his attorney who had taken the time to review the discovery and asked for an adjournment, review the case, and give him the viable defenses, which he had, and the fact shown that he worked on the case.
You have to meet the AEDPA standard in showing that, though, right?
Understood, but no attorney, not even a reasonable one, could have, under these circumstances, provided effective assistance of counsel.
Yes, but we're talking about would it be reasonable to conclude that, even assuming that was inadequate performance, there was prejudice?
There was prejudice.
I mean, I understand you say there was prejudice, but the question is whether the Court of Appeals could conclude reasonably that there was no prejudice. Not that they're right, but that they could conclude it reasonably. I'm just asking what the standard is.
But
is
how
that
could
the standard
they
or not?
Reasonably, that is correct, but how could the Court of Appeals, the Michigan Court of Appeals, reasonably conclude what had no defense simply because in his affidavit he said, I have no attorneys on staff, and they disregarded everything else, and that was their sole reason of why they said he had no defense. This is not a situation where the Michigan courts looked at what he presented, analyzed it, and then said you have no defense. They more than once throughout the opinion state, because this is what you said at your plea colloquy, you cannot come back and say something else. So there is not, this can't be reasonable analysis. This is the definition of unreasonable, because they relied on that one statement that he had no attorneys on staff. When to the contrary, he's provided evidence.
I think we have the argument in hand. Your red light's been on for a while there. You'll have your rebuttal.
I have rebuttal, yes. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Scott Shimkus appearing on behalf of respondent. Starting in August 2011, Ricky White engaged in pre-charge negotiations with the AG's office to pay restitution to the victims of his mortgage fraud scheme. The negotiations went on for nearly a year. A payment plan was reached, but he failed to abide by that. Due to that failure, White was charged. Several months later, White pled guilty in open court. He was represented by multiple counsel during that time. By my count, I believe at least two or three counsel at that time. He now claims, as he did in the state courts, that his plea counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to explain the charges and any potential defenses. But because the Michigan Court of Appeals adjudicated both of those inquiries on the merits, AEDPA applies, as Your Honors noted.
Trust us, we understand AEDPA and where we're at.
So yep. And
why do you think that the defendant, in state court, Mr. White, why do you think he had no viable defense?
So, Your Honor, there were a few reasons. It's not, as Ms. Gabara just noted, that it was simply that he claimed he had attorneys on staff and didn't actually have those attorneys on staff. For instance, the Michigan Court of Appeals pointed out other issues that he claimed to operate a legitimate business. This appears on page 432 of the Michigan Court of Appeals opinion, that he operated a legitimate business, and he essentially claimed that the financial institutions set up roadblocks preventing him from conducting his business. And so they said, well, that wasn't the case because he misrepresented to his clients that he would do this work, and he admitted during his plea colloquy that he accepted this money from his clients with the intent to defraud. That specific language is in the plea agreement.
Right. And that's, but why don't you just set aside his plea colloquy for this purpose? Because Ms. Gabara makes the point that, his representation was pretty shaky in that proceeding. Just what evidence against him did you otherwise have that made clear this guy's got no way out?
Well, Your Honor, it's hard to say what exactly all the evidence was because the evidence outlined available in the record that we have and that this court has, is essentially the representations at the plea colloquy because Mr. White waived a preliminary examination, so there was no testimony in terms of from victims what he did. The other evidence that exists in the record, Your Honor, is from the sentencing hearing where the court read multiple victim impact statements. I believe the court received something over 100 victim impact statements and read from approximately a dozen of them. Okay. That essentially Mr. White ruined the livelihood of many of his victims, that they relied on him to help with their mortgage troubles, and that he failed to do so. He took their money and they didn't see any results. And
he wasn't a lawyer himself, correct?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I don't believe so.
You don't know categorically, flatly? I mean, I'll ask Ms. Gabara, but
my understanding
seemed to be a fairly accessible fact here.
Sure. My understanding is that he was not.
Okay. Well,
it is in the record. It is in the record as well, Your Honor, that he represented, I believe, Mr. Teeger in either the plea colloquy or the sentencing, represented that Mr. White even arguably held himself out at Bronstein & Associates as a law firm of sorts, not just a financial institution. And so I think that was also part of the problem with him representing to have attorneys on staff.
Well, we don't know if he had a P number. Is that what you're saying?
I acknowledge the issue, Your Honor, but I don't know that he had a P number or not. Again, my understanding is that he did not, and that he was not representing he was not putting himself out there as an attorney, but that his company had these attorneys on staff, and that they would legally engage in the mortgage modifications. So As I said, the Michigan Court of Appeals pointed out several problems with his possible defense. And the state trial court, in adjudicating the motion for relief from judgment, pointed out other issues as well. So Ms. Guevara says, for instance, there must be reliance. But the state trial court points out that false pretenses is a complete crime as soon as the defendant lies and takes the money. This is record 5-11, page ID 1959. And so the crime was complete when he took the money with the promise to do the work, and that was it, when he intended to not do the work. And this can be true even if he did complete some of the work. It doesn't have to be the case that he completed none of it. It has to be the case that he completed none, or at least he can carry it through, even for just some victims. In fact, the plea colloquy was based, I believe, only on two victims out of the hundreds that Mr. White had. So for those reasons, he cannot show he cannot show actual prejudice. And as Your Honor is pointing out, the question isn't even necessarily whether he can show prejudice. The question is whether the Michigan courts make a reasonable decision that he couldn't show prejudice. And that is a different inquiry, a much more difficult inquiry, that Mr. White simply has not met in this case. Ms. Guevara points...
Or you could show that there's clearly established law that requires the state court to... take some testimony on what was going on.
That is true, Your Honor, but it's still part of the same inquiry. That it still has to be the case that under that clearly established law, the question is whether the decision was reasonable. And so in this case...
The district court said that Blackledge didn't apply and then wrote a footnote explaining why maybe he was wrong on that, basically.
That is true.
Is that a fair characterization?
That is absolutely true, Your Honor, yes.
And when you read his footnote, you know, made me wonder. Can you address that issue?
Of course. So the district court, as you said, they did come to the conclusion that Blackledge was not clearly established federal law for this point of law, but pointing out that there are nuggets in Blackledge that point to constitutional guarantees or constitutional...
It would be strange if the Constitution... I mean, it's a different case because it involves... getting the federal court involved at a slightly different stage of the proceeding, but it would seem like the underlying constitutional doctrine is pretty square on.
Well,
that if you have a blanket statement in the plea colloquy or in the plea inquiry that you're satisfied or whatever it is, then that just precludes you from showing that you were coerced. If you say, "I was not coerced," and then you say later, "I was coerced into saying I wasn't coerced," you couldn't show that. That would have constitutional implications, I take to be the thrust of Blackledge.
I think that's
true. It seemed like the same principle would apply if the procedure was akin to what we have here. Do you understand my question?
I do understand, Your Honor. I think that's a point that could come up in future cases, that could become clearly established law at some point, but not that Blackledge clearly established that in 1977. In Blackledge, the court specifically said, and I'm quoting from the court here on page 75 of the opinion, "In administering the writ of habeas corpus and its 2255 counterpart, the federal courts cannot fairly adopt this per se rule." It does not speak whatsoever to the state courts or that decision, that point of law, is under the Constitution. It's pointing to habeas corpus. And really the reason for that, Your Honor, or at least we can sort of surmise that the reason for that, is based on how Congress amended AEDPA later on, 20 years later in 1996, to show that it's much more difficult to get a hearing under AEDPA than it was originally under the original writ, and especially Section 2255.
There's nothing in Blackledge that says we're using the Constitution to come to this conclusion.
That is true, Your Honor. Again, there are pieces of Blackledge that use the word constitutional or constitutional guarantee. So there is some allusion to it, I suppose, but the decision isn't made under the Constitution. The court is essentially saying that the writ tries to, give petitioners this opportunity through the federal courts, but doesn't say that that same opportunity has to be provided by the state courts. There's nothing, whether it's Blackledge or any other case, as Judge Clay pointed out, that says the state courts must consider this post-colloquy affidavit that contradicts the petitioner's statements at the plea colloquy. Now, the other
does
part...
seem a little strange that the state court can do something that can decline to do something that the federal court can't decline to do when the issue that they're addressing is the same issue.
If I may, Your Honor, I believe the difference there is it might be the case that federal courts have to do that on a direct appeal, in a federal charge for a federal defendant. It might be the case that they have to do it there. But that's why Blackledge doesn't apply here to the state courts, or it wouldn't even apply in the federal conviction case.
State because court in Blackledge, though, right?
Pardon?
It's a state court in Blackledge, though.
Correct, Your Honor, but my point there was that this is why it goes to the federal habeas procedure, not to the direct procedure. This is talking about collateral review. So we're talking about after the conviction, after any appeals, now it's coming to the federal courts in a very different context through habeas. And because that is a collateral review, the Supreme Court in Blackledge was very concerned about finality. And that's, really an overarching concern for habeas is finality. So they're grappling with the need to have finality in these cases and to possibly give the petitioner an avenue of at least adjudicating his claim. And so the court there said the way that we could allow him to at least adjudicate his claim is by giving him a hearing or, allowing him...
It seems strange if you're talking about finality and the deference under habeas to say that we're not going to insist that the state court do it, but we are going to insist that it be done at the federal level, which is seem like the policy you're adverting to would be the other way around.
Again, Your Honor, I think I have to just fall back on the context, the specific collateral context of habeas. I think that's the real difference here, as opposed to some type of direct appeal, whether that's in the state courts or the federal courts. And as Your Honors are well aware, habeas isn't meant to act as a second direct appeal. It truly is collateral. I think with that, Your Honors, again, we pointed this out in our brief, but the Lee case that counsel points to, that is a true 2255 case, and 2255 is a very different animal than 2254, especially when it comes to evidentiary hearings. Evidentiary hearings are, from my understanding, more or less required in 2255 cases, unless there's a good reason not to. Whereas 2254 is more or less the reverse of that. And that's especially true if there was an adjudication on the merits, a federal evidentiary hearing is barred. And that's exactly what we have here is a merits adjudication. Really, with that, Your Honors, unless you have any further questions, I will cede the rest of my time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Yes. And a lot stuck. I think it's interesting that opposing counsel said that this issue could come up in the future, but not under these facts. We have the facts here. Yes, Blackledge is pre-EDPA, but the Constitution and Blackledge talks about constitutional guarantees, and when there's a due process violation, as it was here, because Mr. White's plea was not voluntary and not knowing due to his counsel's deficient performance, an adoption of a per se rule, as the state courts did here, in violation of the Constitution, frustrates the court's ability to sufficiently protect Mr. White's and every defendant's rights that later wishes to attack his plea. And like I said, he could have been outside with a gun in his head and he had come back inside and pled guilty and then put that in an affidavit, the courts would have simply ignored it. And I don't believe U.S. Supreme Court precedent or the Constitution would allow a block on every defendant that pled guilty and that wants to later challenge his plea. I believe that allowing a defendant to reasonably show an opportunity that why his statements were contrary, as did Mr. White here, is the reasonable method. And one thing I wanted to address, pre-charge negotiation. Pre-charge negotiation are very different from being charged and being in court and facing the consequences of what it would be if you plead guilty. The fact that Mr. White was involved in pre-charge negotiations show that he may have had some defense, that the Attorney General did not rush to charge him from the beginning, that in fact he was trying to fight his case. So pre-charge negotiations help him rather than hurt him. And there's no record of why those pre-charge negotiations stopped. It had nothing to do with him not making payments or things like that. There's absolutely no record of why those stops, and I would not be able to answer that. I'm just wanting to make it clear. It had nothing to do with payments.
Was he a lawyer?
He was not a lawyer, but he, okay. And I want to differentiate, making a statement that we have attorneys on staff,
right.
And he didn't, there's also no record that he represented that Bronstein and Associates was a law firm either.
Okay.
It's the only record is that he said we have attorneys on staff. Thank you.
Thanks for your argument.
Thank you
very much. And the case is submitted. Clerk, call the next case.